ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Dying Time is here. That's right, we're talking Friday the 13th, part 2, Kill by Kill. Greetings and salutations, Internet. This is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. We're going to unpack all the gory details of Friday the 13th, part 2, in the hopes that a camp counselor's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them.
I'm coming to you from Camp Crystal Lake, or as close to it as we could possibly get. I'm here on the West Coast, and my cohort, my partner in crime, comes to us from the hinterlands of New York City. It's the one, the only, Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
I am well, Patrick. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm sweltering because at the time of this recording, the world has decided to be on fire.
There's just you've got that like slow motion man in flames running down the street. You've got the theme from The Omen playing every time you open your front door.
Yes, it's the cartoon devils with pitchforks, the whole nine yards.
You've got that sound effect whenever they cut to hell on South Park. The yeah!
Exactly. And it's just really hot on top of it. It just happens to be super, super hot. So I'm in a different room in the house. I'm not in the office. I'm in my son's toy room looking at what appears to be the world's largest supply of Hot Wheels. I know that's not to be true, but in the size of our house, that's the way it appears. So if you hear a little ambient noise, please forgive both of us this is the way life goes.
We are not professional podcasters.
I don't know if anyone's noticed. We're not.
Neither of us have noise-canceling software, so just deal with fans and air conditioners blowing in the background, because we have limits to suffering for our art.
Yeah. They're very low limits. Speaking of suffering, let's get to the crux of why we are here today. And just to remind everyone is that we are going through currently the Friday the 13th film series. And we are looking at that most denigrated component of any horror film, the characters. Because a camp counselor's death is only the beginning of our discussion about them. We've gone through several so far, but not as many as you might think. And we're up to Vicky. Vicky is a brunette gal who is very open about her wants and desires for sexual gratification with a guy named Mark.
Who is now deceased at this point.
Who sadly has gone the way of disco. So, okay, let's talk about Vicky. She's actually a lovely person. She and Mark seem like the most normal people in the entire group. She is very forward that she would like Mark's penis somewhere near her vagina.
And she doesn't seem to have any doubts that even though he is in a wheelchair, that, you know, everything is in that regard is in proper working order.
She comes right out and asks.
Oh, that's right. She does, doesn't she? Yeah.
She comes right out and asks, is everything okay down there? And his response is, you know, I get by, which I don't doubt.
You gotta figure
it's not
that's
out
a,
of the realm of possibility.
You figure that's gonna be a great pickup line. You know, he's a good looking guy. He's in a wheelchair. It's like, I really, really just want to be made to feel like a man again. Can you help me? You're kind of make it seem like he's not sure if things will work, but you know, maybe you're the woman that can make a miracle.
Yeah, that's right. Makes everyone feel good.
Because me, I mean, if I had that line given to me and it worked, I would be just walking on air for the next couple of days. I would just be like bragging left and right. You know, I'm a miracle worker. I brought life back to the dead.
That's right. You made it stand up and pay attention.
Exactly.
So she plays around with Mark in various ways. They duel via electronic game. Finally, after just laying on as thick as humanly possible, she goes, do you want to stay together tonight? And he goes, oh, I was just going to ask you the same thing. I'm like, well, like hours have passed, guys. You could have totally been having sex like a million times by now. Just do it already. And she says, hey, hold on just one second. She goes off to her cabin. Mark ends up dead.
Mark gets machete to the face.
Like he had it coming or something, which he did not.
And an epic roll down the stairs.
So Vicky goes to her cabin, and here we get gamesmanship from Jason, I guess. The plug for the lamp has been pulled out for some reason, and she plugs it back in and calls her roommate a turkey. She changes out of one sweater into her sexy sweater. Is that what I'm to take from this? She's got a perfectly decent sweater, changes out of that because, I don't know, the funk of the day, and then puts on another sweater like, yeah, this is my I'm getting lucky sweater.
Remember when you were a kid and you wore that shirt, it's when you were like five, and it says like, it just said football, 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 football across the front of it. You know what I'm talking about, right? Every little boy had that sweat. Every little boy that grew up in the 70s had that picture in like second grade of the shirt that said football, football, football across the front of it.
I'm sure I do. I don't have photographic evidence of it, but I will cede the floor to this point.
Maybe hers said sex, sex, sex on it. I don't know. A fine detailed pattern of pornographic pictures. Maybe it was something a little more subliminal than that. There was obviously a reason that this was the sweater put on for sexy results.
Yes. This is after, of course, she bathes herself in perfume, including the thing I initially remember the most about this movie when I first watch it. And that was Vicky spraying her nether regions with perfume. And I was like, that's a thing that women do? By the way, I don't believe that's a thing that women do.
Well,
this is why I needed a woman on the show. Gina, please educate dipshit dude like myself.
If you're going to be camping, things are going to get a little ripe. And I think that, you know, you want to be at your best, you know, as far as now why she didn't just go grab a shower somewhere, which, you know, what probably would have been for, you know, more optimal results. But I mean, sometimes when one uses the phrase freshen up, it means to, you know, make that area, you know, as pleasingly scented as possible.
Okay. The more you know.
Star and rainbow.
Star and rainbow. So she has an entire sexy set. She's got new panty, new bra, new sweater, new pants, same nurse shoes. Goes back to the cabin, and no one seems to be about the main cabin. And then she creeps up the stairs and immediately goes to inquire what the Sam Hill is going on from Jeff and Sandra. And this is where we get The Long Game by Jason, where he is waiting underneath the covers for her to see what that blood stain's all about. And I think that's, while it works for him, kind of a bad plan.
Well, yeah.
Because it only works if she gives a shit about anyone else in the cabin, or checks with Jeff and Sandra, who up until this point have been boning nonstop.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know why she feels the need to check on them. I mean, it's you know,
because the script tells her to. That's the only reason.
I mean, I can't imagine
stage direction. Vicky goes to Jeff and Sandra's room. That's the only motivation for this. And it's the only reason Jason is lying in wait inside bloody sheets for another person to enter the room, because there's no guarantee that she would ever go in there.
Yeah, he shows a lot of implausible foresight in this, which is a little hard to believe, you know, because one could consider that the only person he has been around in the past 5 years is his mother's severed head.
Yeah.
So how would he, you know, develop this insight into people's...
I don't know.
Into people's motives and personalities.
Not too long ago, you came up with the idea that Jason has a sort of connection to people's fuck style. Perhaps this is part of that sort of telepathic connection that he has to people's sex wants and desires.
He gathered that that Vicky would go check on Jeff and Sandra.
Jeff and Sandra, just to see what's doing. Yeah, sure, I guess.
I mean, she might ask them for tips, maybe ask them if they have, you know, extra condoms. I don't know, yeah. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. Jeff and Sandra are not using
I was going to say, as if anybody was using condoms in these movies.
Pa and Lise. None of these people have wrapped anything up.
I don't think condoms were even mentioned in a movie till like, probably 1997 or so. You know,
I think maybe the remake is the first time anyone mentions a condom in any of this.
And Jeff's probably the type of guy who'll say, I can't feel anything.
I can only imagine the lame-ass excuses Jeff has for not even giving a damn whether or not Sandra ends up pregnant. But let's leave our debate about pregnant people dying in a Friday 13th movie for part three. Sneak preview.
Yes.
We got that coming. So, unfortunately, this is where Sandra bites it. Jason leaps up like the backwoods ninja that he is and slices her thigh open through her lovely pleated khakis. And then she cowers right next to the open door. I don't know why she can't escape or attempt to escape, but she's yet another in a long string of designated crumplers.
I was going to say, this was pretty much identical to, I don't even remember the character's name anymore, but there's a death in the first one. Whichever one of them got the axe to the face. It was
Marcy.
Marcy, right.
So yeah, she just crumples to the ground. Jason holds up a knife to camera so that we can see a weird bruise on his thumb.
And let us not forget to mention that, again, as is a pattern in this movie, he's holding the knife the wrong way.
Yeah, he's holding it blade up instead of blade down. It boggles the mind. And then she gets it by stab to the body area. Who knows?
I just think it's like she got stabbed in the stomach or something.
Yeah.
She got
something
She gets stabbed in the stomach, spits out some Party City fake blood, and that's the end of Vicky.
Vicky, R.I.P.D. So, in the meantime, while all these deaths have occurred, these poor dead people have missed the Roadhouse experience of a lifetime at Casino Bar. Can we talk for a moment about the scene at Casino Bar?
Featuring Ted, the luckiest asshole in any of the Friday the 13th movies.
A person deserving of death simply for his attitude about life alone. But just before we get to any character specifics, the people who are in the band and the people who are drinking beer and listening to that band are some of the oddest amalgamation of individuals I've ever seen amassed in one locale. To the point where it's so weirdly countrified for New Jersey that I'm like, well, hey, Urban Cowboy called, and they're like, you showed up to the wrong set. Everyone is bearded. Everyone has slightly tinted glasses on. There's a little too much open collar and cowboy hat. There's not nearly enough women at all. It's a sausage fest. And then as we watch this poor beleaguered waitress / bartender make her way back to the sidebar area where Ted comes on to her by ogling her with empty beer bottles. And I'm going to come out and say that's not a turn on.
No.
But that's his way of getting in with her, is making himself seem like a drunken asshole. Because she doesn't see any of those working in a bar.
I'm looking at where they the location shots for the exteriors of Friday 13th Part 2.
Yes.
And I just can't help thinking that this sort of looks a little bit like Porky's.
It has a Porky's-esque vibe. Yeah. I'm not going to say you're wrong. You know.
It just looks like it's about ready to, like, be dragged into the water by a bunch of high school-age assholes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think high school-age assholes is the demo for, quote-unquote, Casino Bar. Which the only thing you're gambling there is whether or not you get an STD this week. It's an odd grouping. There's also a lot of stuffed animals who are given a lot of play in the background. And then now we're treated to this exchange between Ted, Paul, and Ginny, where Ginny, this is where we get her college psych class understanding of what Jason is. And then two men looking at her like, you're a dummy, girl. That's about it.
Yeah, I think it's some vague attempt at character development in a movie that really does not require it.
I mean, they're trying to make it a thing. They're trying to make Fetch happen here by psychoanalyzing Jason. She basically calls, she's like a backwoods Clarice Starling here. Jason is a child in a man's body who, quote unquote, never knew death until he saw his mother beheaded. Why would that be the only thing that Jason saw?
Yeah,
you're telling me he only showed up to see his mom bite it, but missed all the other death and dismemberment that happened before this? His ticket was for the decapitation of his mother and not any of the other kills in the first movie.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know if she didn't do a you take your child to work day while making short work of Kevin Bacon and...
Now, Jason, don't show up until I lure this girl down by the shore. That's when I want you to see me kill this person after tussling with them and biting them. None of it really lines up. Which makes it all the more infuriating that the smartest person in the entire movie is forced to say it to the two dumbest people. And I'm specifically talking about Paul and Ted. Paul is a sex dummy, because that's the only thing he could possibly be bringing to the table.
Yeah, I don't know that I would trust him to teach people how to be in charge of young children.
I don't quite understand it, because he doesn't listen to anybody. In that scene where... Deputy Winslow comes in and goes, hey, you should probably not let your counselors go to the site of a murder, multiple murder, because it was only 5 years ago and it might happen again. Could you set off the murder alarm? I don't know. But Paul's like, I don't care. Screw off.
Sort of looks and acts like someone you see in an ad for English leather. That's all he really brings to the table.
He's a quality Sears model.
He's kind of blandly handsome, and again, that very 1970s sort of way. And I realize this is supposed to be like 81,
but it's got the stink of the 70s all over, because fashion just hasn't turned over.
And he has the personality and charisma of a magazine model.
Yes. Yeah. I assume that he did a lot of stand-ups for tight-fitting pants, things that were Sansa-belted, perhaps. And he just won't listen to what anyone else has to say. And Ted isn't helping at all.
No.
So it's at this point that Jenny's like, well, screw you two, I'm going. And Paul's like, oh, wait up for me, because I want to have sex with you later. And it's at this moment you can clearly see come across her face that she regrets ever having relations with this dipshit.
We've all had that moment. We've all had that moment where we're out somewhere with someone and they just say something just so unbelievably stupid. And you're like, I cannot believe I took my clothes off in front of this person.
Yeah. Once they get back to camp, they, like everyone else, head to the main house and start calling out for everybody. And no one answers. Ginny knows the score. Somehow. She knows something's wrong. And she tells him constantly, this isn't right. We should go get somebody. We should go get some help. They would just leave. This is a problem. And Paul's like, you have a vagina. I think I'm the smarter person here.
Who runs this business anyway?
It's obviously, I'm the person in charge of this. I have the clipboard. I'm just going to saunter into this situation, which... every signal would tell you is not normal and is not right. Up until the point where they enter the room where a killer is, and Jenny says, there's someone else in this room. Paul's like, what? And she's like, there's someone else in this fucking room. And then Jason leaps out at them. Like, she has said over and over and over again, wake up, dummy. This is a bad sitch. And he's like, I don't care. I have very blonde hair. I'm fine.
I wear English leather or nothing at all. And again, let us point out, let us clarify yet again, he is ostensibly running a business that trains people on how to be camp counselors.
Yeah.
That will in turn be in charge of children. Mm-hmm. And has absolutely no ability to assess a potentially dangerous situation whatsoever.
I am mystified as to how he gained the reputation that Deputy Winslow attributes to him.
This is the type of person where if a child fell down in front of him and broke his bones to the point the bone is sticking out of the skin, then he would say, "You're fine, walk it off, don't be a pussy." And then leave alone at that.
There's nothing about him that reeks authority, other than the fact that he's ostensibly in charge. It's the Peter principle writ large. He just owns this place, and no one can wrest control away from this dummy. Until Jason does, or at least attempts to, with a pitchfork of all things. And they struggle back and forth in a very unchoreographed fight, while Ginny kind of whimpers. It's a very un-Ginny-like moment, where she just, "Paul, Paul, Paul," while he's in the middle of a fight. I don't, because the rest of the time she doesn't act this way. So I'm not entirely sure what the motivation for this moment was.
I'm not sure why they didn't just kill him off, like, immediately. It was like they couldn't decide if they were going to make him be the hero in the end or not. They almost wrote him out of the script at that point. Yeah, because apparently it was to seem more clear what happened to Paul.
Yeah.
But I think because they just didn't know what to do with the character, they just, I don't know. It's very strange that, you know, all the people that Jason does not kill off, you know, it's him.
He's the most deserving in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, certainly in this movie he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably top five most irritating characters overall.
The more I watch it, he to me is more irritating than our trickster character in our next film.
That's a tough sell. You're going to have to present possibly a complete PowerPoint presentation.
I'm going to have to justify my love of this particular point, but this is the bold statement I'm making right now. Paul is mystifying as an individual. He's unqualified as a leader, and I won't vote for him. I won't.
He will not make America great again.
No. He couldn't even he make won't even Camp make, Crystal
yeah,
Lake
I was gonna say he
again.
Won't even make yeah, he won't even make the Pine Lands of Southern New Jersey great again.
Now we get to the point where this movie actually takes off in terms of its directorial panache. Because I will also make a bold claim. I think this is the best non-telekinesis related cat and mouse game of any of the Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah, I mean, the rest of the movie isn't all that great. A lot of it is very much a rehash of the first one, but I mean, this final scene it pretty well makes up for it.
I think so. It's definitely an improvement over the cat and mouse game that came before it.
Yeah,
and it has everything to do with how the director is approaching this material. He's able to, one, everything suddenly gets dark. Two, Jason is aware of where the frame of the camera is, even if Ginny isn't. And there's legitimate boo scares that happen here that are not empty threats. They are Jason leaping out because he's at a different side of the frame than he was before. This happens at the car. This happens with the pitchfork through the top of it. There's just a lot of fun play and a lot of tension being built and released. And then we get the coup de grace, if I can mispronounce something in French, where Ginny is trapped underneath a bed and becomes so scared that she pees herself. And that's not the problem. It's that the trail of pee that's coming out will give her away. That's kind of genius.
That's one of those things you don't really see in horror movies too much, the realistic possibility that you will urinate yourself in the face of imminent death, which
it's an underused liquid in a very liquid filled genre.
It's a oddly realistic touch. Probably the last time any of these movies in the series tried to be anywhere near realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder if that was, you know, in the script, or they thought, hey, you know what? Why don't we make it look like you peed yourself?
It's an interesting gag because it doesn't, you don't think less of Jenny in that situation, because the film has become legitimately exciting to watch at that moment. She's been able to evade him by just thinking smart, get into a car. Okay, the car is not working. Get to shelter. I can't close off the door. I'm gonna hide and hope that he passes by, and it's working up until the point where the pee trail might give her away. She's very smart about it, and Jason appears a very clever pursuer.
You know, you could look at it as her that she's betrayed by her own body.
It's a pretty sterling little sequence for a very cheapy franchise. All of that directorial goodwill will be flushed down the toilet once a 3D camera is involved. Spoiler alert. So, let's conclude the sequence. Jenny then wanders off into the woods, and there seems to be a shorter distance between here and Camp Crystal Lake than I was given the impression of previously, or it's just time is shortened within the editing of the film. But she also happens to find Jason's bat cave in the middle of the woods and discovers the severed head of Mrs. Voorhees,
which I would like to point out again, has somehow managed to grow hair. She had that, you know, in the last movie, she had the, you know, sensible older mom short haircut. A lot of our mothers get that at some point.
It's hard to take care of. It's a better do.
And now she's got some sort of like Halloween witch hair going on.
It's an Albert Einstein sort of look. But I would say for a severed head that's 5 years old, it's not the best look. And the combo here is resplendent with her bloody sweater, which Jason got out of evidence somehow.
The first time I saw this movie, and when Jenny puts the sweater on, mm-hmm. all I could think was, my God, how bad that thing must have smelled.
Yeah.
I mean, and she just puts it on, doesn't even like, ugh! You know, when you get that little retching where it's mm-hmm. like you smell something really bad and you know, and you just make that little filthy, bloody, probably corpse juice covered.
Corpse juice.
You know, just imagine just the horrible smell of this thing.
Is that trademarked?
If it's not, it is now. There's another hashtag for you. Last week was sex sandwich, or no, sad sandwich. This week, hashtag corpse juice.
Corpse juice brought to you by Mountain Dew.
That'll be our equipment. We'll start doing ads for the corpse juice, like
filled to the brim, as it were, with corpse juice. And her idea is now to use this Psych 101 knowledge that we've seen her display earlier against Jason. And we know that Jenny can outsmart people, because much earlier in the film, we saw her beat Paul at chess.
That really been that difficult, though.
I mean, also believe that Muffin could have beaten Paul at chess. if I were asked. That said, she beats him handily, and he looks at that chessboard like I look at a Star Trek 3D chess. Or how Michael Myers looks at the corpse of that one body and tilts his head to the side.
Because that puppy dog, like, tilt to the head thing.
But how could this possibly happen? I mean, she is woman and I am Paul. I don't know that Paul is necessarily a misogynist character, but he's not smart enough to be enlightened. Let's put it out that way. Paul, non-woke bae. Put it down. If you were keeping track of the woke bays of Friday the 13th.
There are zero so far.
Exactly zero so far. So, okay, she's got this idea nailed. I'm going to impersonate Jason's dead mother by wearing his sweater, or her sweater, pardon me. And he buys it.
Yeah, because now apparently he has gone back into, again, sort of feral brain damage mode.
Right, he's not the kind of guy who can track down the lone victim of your mother's killing spree 5 years after the fact. Now he's just a dipshit with a pillowcase over his head who looks at a sweater and goes, oh, that must be my mom.
Yeah, and she's alive again. I saw her head get her head lopped off. Yeah. Like a salami in a delicatessen.
That's right. But I knew nothing of death before this, so this makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm totally buying this 100%.
Oh, yeah, sure. Springing elaborate traps. But this I am going to fall for like Coyote.
She's pretty much painting a road on a wall and like waiting for him to just run into it. This is how implausible this trick is. And even more implausible that it works. And the really funny thing is again, spoiler for future episodes, this is used again in a different, even more implausible variation. In part 4, was it?
Isn't there, in part 7, doesn't she also implant the idea?
Yes. This is someone rising? This is not done numerous times, and he falls for it every time.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing that he got away with as much murder as he did. He's kind of a dipshit.
Hot takes. Patrick, hot take. Patrick's not having Jason.
Hot rake. This guy is not the sharpest tool in the shed, and he has several of them, and he uses them on people.
So you would think he would know sharpest tools.
You would think. So here we go. This all works right up to the point where she asks him to kneel in front of him, so she can bury a machete in his head. And then it works until it doesn't, and he deflects the machete with a pickaxe, and then she gets sliced by the razor-sharp pickaxe. They tussle and tossle, and out of nowhere comes the not-quite-corpse of Paul to save the day! Oh, thank goodness. Paul's back.
Yay, Paul is back. We were so worried about what happened to Paul.
Because we wouldn't want Jenny to resolve this using her own wits and strength as she's been able to survive this so far. She needs to be rescued by that mop of hair attached to an empty head. So they have another unchoreographed fight. Luckily, Jenny is here. Otherwise, all of this would descend into chaos. Because she manages, while they're in mid-tussle, to bury a machete into his shoulder. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has got to fucking hurt.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's on the pain scale, that's, you know, probably up there with, you know, having your mask strap squeeze so hard that, like, brain juice starts flowing out and having, you know, the machete buried into your face, and then you kind of do this slow slide on the floor where it, like, goes all the way into your head.
Yeah. That was incredibly descriptive, Gina, almost as if you've given way too much thought to
it. I'm thinking way ahead on other episodes here.
Okay. So you're not just riffing off the top of your head?
No, I'm really not. I'm thinking of future ways that Jason is supposedly dispatched of.
To actually be severed to that degree. And it's buried down to basically the top of his pec is nuts that he isn't crumpled, that he's able to then pick himself up. Dust himself off.
Yeah, I mean,
with one arm.
His arm, then, like, you know, his arm appears to be pretty, you know, usable by the end of the movie. So
I don't understand how he can crash through a window hands first when one of those hands should not be able to raise.
I mean, he should basically just be like just flopping like an empty sleeve.
Yes, like a disconnected fish. Just limp, a noodle. But no, he's only slightly worse for wear when he confronts Paul and Jenny later on by going headfirst through a window in this film's version of the Carrie moment / Jason comes out of the lake moment. Then we go to white yet again. And Jenny wakes up on a stretcher. We don't know where Jason is. We don't know if Paul's alive.
Oh no, Paul. I hope he's okay.
I know. I've been staying up nights. My hands are so raw from ringing thinking about where Paul is.
You woke up a couple nights. Ah, Paul!
My wife is very worried when I wake up constantly yelling, Paul, is Paul okay? This is a new phenomenon in our marriage, and she's a little disquieted by it. Yeah, that's the end of Friday the 13th, part two. Jenny's left alive. We don't know what the fuck Paul is doing. Jason recovers miraculously from having his entire shoulder severed, basically.
It's also established that he is, I mean, it kind of is when you see, like, the shot of him as a kid, but it also established that he is, in fact, hideously deformed.
Yeah.
We don't know what sort of toxic waste Mrs. Voorhees was ingesting when she was pregnant, but he sort of looks like if someone had taken the Elephant Man and set him on fire and then pushed him down a long flight of stairs.
Yeah, I mean, if the idea was that he was going to grow into his looks, they were sadly mistaken.
I mean, Jason the kid, and again, you only see him, it's kind of a, you know, far away shot in the water. He sort of looks like he has like one big fried egg eye, which, you know, again, I don't really know the nature of what his problems are supposed to be.
And I don't think they cared. That was completely based off of a kid Tom Savini had known from the old neighborhood in Pittsburgh.
But now, I mean, but now he's basically just a mutant. He looks a little different in every movie.
Yes.
Like the nature of his deformity keeps changing.
In the middle of this stunt, the makeup changes, Gina.
Yes.
He leaps through and he looks one way, and then you cut to the other part of the slow-mo and it's a very different makeup on him, or at least the appearance of. It just really, really changes. So, yeah. And his appearance from here to part three is, again, completely different because male pattern baldness means that he loses all of his stringy hair between the events of this.
This guy just can't catch a break. I mean,
no. I mean, what he had going for him at that stage of life is a flowing mane of locks. And now that's gone. What does that do to his self-confidence?
I have to point out that supposedly you did learn in the original cut of Friday the 13th part 2.
Okay.
You were supposed to find out the fate of Paul, in which then Ginny asks where Paul is. And apparently this was filmed. I don't know if it is available as a bonus material.
But I haven't. There are no deleted scenes on the Blu-ray. Okay, then they
wisely crumpled it up and threw it in the trash after they filmed it, because evidently when Ginny asks where Paul is, it cuts to Mrs. Voorhees' head, which opens its eyes and smiles as if to say, "I know where Paul is." Wink.
Sort of the Deadpool from Wolverine Origins sort of wink at the camera.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And you know, again, they did have a severed head winking later in the series, but it was not Mrs. Voorhees.
You know, I kind of, now that I know that that exists, that's all I want.
This is going to become the day the clown cried. You're going to comb every possible outlet.
Hey, we already got a half an hour of that. How long is it going to take? I call upon you, people at Paramount Pictures / Warner Brothers, whoever now currently owns the rights to this but doesn't want to do anything with it.
It's got
to
be called the Give Us Head campaign. There's our first t-shirt, ladies and gentlemen. Look for it on Cafe Press. Kill by Kill on the front, Give Us Head on the back.
On the back. I'm sweating. That's how much I'm thinking about all the monies that are coming my way from that venture.
You need to turn that kid's playroom into a Scrooge McDuck money vault, because it's rolling, baby. It's rolling.
I'm swimming in them coins. Them bitcoins that are coming my way. That's Friday the 13th part 2. Do you RIPD, maybe, to Paul? Who knows?
Who cares?
Kind of.
Who cares?
We'll never know. So do you have any other final words to say about this kind of good, kind of horrible movie?
I will say that it seems to have the most iconic shots in it. Mm-hmm. Like definitely when he leaps out of the bed at Vicky, sex kebab.
Yes.
Which, you know, inspired not as many copycat scenes as I seem to recall, but a few.
Yes. And it's itself being a copycat.
Yeah. And so I would definitely say that despite it being a pretty mediocre movie after all, it does have probably the most iconic shots of any in the series.
I would agree with that. Gina, before we go, of course, where can we find you on the internet?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
All right. You can reach out to us via email at killbykillpod@gmail.com or Twitter at killbykillpod. And please rate and review us on iTunes if you like the show. Let your friends know, but that's the best way to help us in the rankings get us seen by more people and be seen by more fans like yourself. And hopefully we can introduce our podcast to more and more people as we go.
Let us hear from you. We want to hear what you have to say. Let us know if we need a Give Us Head t-shirt. I think that would be awesome. Hashtag corpse juice. Don't worry, folks. The body count will continue. Until next time, for myself and for Gina, bye-bye, everybody.
Goodbye, everyone.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.